There are few prospects so replete with romantic possibility, so entirely suited to a soul trembling in morbid awe, as the ruins of an English abbey. Picture, if you will, the tumbled stones where once a tonsured friar muttered matins, the echoing coruscation of the cloister, now opened to the sky, the soaring architraves of Gothic stone that oppress one's soul as with the weight of tombs, vanished incense curling at the nostril, the haunting memory of chanted prayer, sonorous and unintelligible to an ear untrained in Latin, the ghostly tolling of a bell whose clapper is muted now forever. Oh, to walk in such a place under the chill of moonlight of a summer evening, when the air off the Solent might stir the dead to speak. In such an hour I could imagine myself a heroine straight from Mrs. Radcliffe's pen, the white train of my gown sweeping over the ancient stones, my shadow but a wraith before me, and all the world suspended in silence between the storied past and the prosaic present. Engaging as such visions must be, I have never ventured to Netley Abbey, for it is of Netley I would speak, it being the closest object to a romantic ruin we possess in Southampton, in anything but the broadest day. I am far too sensible a lady to linger in such a deserted place, with the darkling wood at my back and the sea to the fore, when the comfort of a home fire beckons. Thus we find the abyss that falls between the fancies of horrid novels and the habits of those who read them. "Aunt Jane?" "Yes, George?" I glance towards the bow, where my two nephews, George and Edward, surveyed the massive face of Netley Castle as it rose on the port side of the small skiff. "Why do they call that place a castle, aunt? It looks nothing like."
"'Tis a Solent fort, you young nubbins," grunted Mr. Hawkins, our seafaring guide. "Built in King Henry's time, when the abbey lands were taken. In a prime position for defending the water, it is. They ought never to have spiked those guns."
"But we have Portsmouth at the Solent mouth, Mr. Hawkins," Edward observed, "and must trust to the entire force of the navy to preserve us against the threat from France."
The elder of the two boys, 14 to George's 13, Edward prided himself on his cool intelligence. As my brother's heir, he was wont to assume the attitudes of a young man of fortune. My nephews had come to me lately from Steventon, after a brief visit to my brother James, a visit that I am certain will live forever in their youthful memories as the most mournful of their experience. I say this without intending a slight upon the benevolence of my eldest brother, nor of his insipid and cheese-paring wife, for the tragedy that overtook our Edward and George was entirely due to Providence. Nearly a fortnight has passed since a messenger out of Kent conveyed the dreadful intelligence how Elizabeth Austen, the boy's mother and mistress of my brother Edward's fine estate at Godmersham, had retired after dinner only to fall dead of a sudden fit. Elizabeth, so elegant and charming, despite her numerous progeny. Elizabeth, unbowed as it seemed by the birth of her 11th child in the last days of September. The surgeon could make nothing of the case. He declared it to be improbable, but dead our Lizzie was, despite the surgeon's protestations, and buried she has been a week since in the small Norman church of St. Lawrence's, where I attended her so often to Sunday service. I suspect that too much breeding is at the heart of the trouble, but too much breeding is the lot of all women who marry young, particularly when they are so fortunate as to make a love match. Elizabeth Bridges, third daughter of a baronet, was but 18 when she wed, and only 35 when she passed from this life. With her strength of character, she ought to have lived to be 80.